A whole gang of media snoopers, including Jonathan Marks, scans from D.C. to daylight every Thursday here on Radio Netherlands. Their super-duper whopper-doppler receiver gizmos pick out the essence of what's happening in the world of international broadcasting. Radio Netherlands, we have the technology.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Radio Netherlands, not national, but international, broadcasting direct from Northwest Europe. Media Network, the weekly communications magazine with Diana Janssen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and we've just slipped away from the Towards 2000 International Broadcasting Conference to present this week's edition of Media Network. Glad you could join us. Sitting opposite me is Andy Sennett, editor of the World Radio TV Handbook in Amsterdam, who has been listening to the radio despite the rather variable conditions of the last few days. What have you got for us, Andy?
Well, we've also been getting a lot of information coming into the editorial office, Diana, so I'll start with this interesting item from Equatorial Guinea. Pan-American Broadcasting, which broadcasts religious programming in English from that country under the name Radio Africa, tells us it now has an additional service called Radio Africa No. 2, which broadcasts Mondays to Fridays between 07 and 11 hours UTC on 15190 kHz, 15190, with a power of 50 kilowatts. That's in addition to the evening transmissions of Radio Africa at 1650 to 23 hours UTC on 7190 kHz, and the service called Radio East Africa, which broadcasts on Saturdays and Sundays between 07 and 16 hours UTC on 15190 kHz.
But the transmitter is actually leased from the government station Radio Nacional.
That's right, and this is where things get interesting, because according to a detailed update I received from the chief engineer, there's apparently a 1 kilowatt transmitter available in Bata, which we didn't know about before. This is listed as a standby transmitter on 5005 kHz, where the main transmitter is 50 kilowatts. The alternative frequency of 4926 kHz is also listed as 50 kilowatts. Now, most of the time, the station uses one or other of those two frequencies, but occasionally in the past I've heard both simultaneously, and the spare 1 kilowatt transmitter would explain that. It seems it's also used as a standby for Radio Africa on both 7190 and 15190 kHz.
Okay, now to Europe.
And we've news of a DX test by an unlicensed station in Ireland. American DXer Chuck Ripple has arranged for Radio Caroline Dublin to broadcast between midnight and 20 hours UTC on Sunday the 24th of September. The power will be 40 watts, and the frequency will be 6260 kHz. 6260. Correct reports containing 10 to 15 minutes of program details, a self-addressed envelope, and two international reply coupons will be verified with the QSL card. The address is Radio Caroline, 24 Lower O'Connell Street, Dublin 1 in Ireland.
Meanwhile, you have some news from Asia.
Indeed, I had a most interesting answer from the National Radio of Cambodia, and at last we have details of the power of their shortwave transmitters. The one on 4907 kHz, 4907, which carries the domestic service, is 50 kilowatts. The other domestic outlet on 6090 kHz, 6090, has a power of just 15 kilowatts. The hours of transmission have been extended, and the domestic service is now on the air 12 and a half hours a day, from 22:30 to 07 hours and 11 to 15 hours UTC. And they also indicate that the 120 kilowatt medium-wave transmitter on 918 kHz is active again, along with 740 kHz, which is now 150 kilowatts. The street address has also changed. It's now 106 Preah Kosamak Street, I'll spell that, P-R-E-A-H, new word, K-O-S-S-A-M-A-K, Preah Kosamak Street in Phnom Penh.
What lies behind the truth? Radio Netherlands investigates.
If you lived in Turkey 20 years ago, there was little in the way of Western and Turkish pop music to be found on the dial. But that changed in the late 70s with the launch of Turkish police radio. It used shortwave to reach across this large country because they only had one transmitter. This very different police station became known throughout the country as a source of music for young people. But, as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, its days may be numbered.
These are the sounds you'd normally associate with the police. But in Turkey, for many people, it would be this.
Evet sevgili dinleyiciler, şu anda 94.1 İstanbul Polis Radyosu'ndasınız. Yayınımız canlı olarak devam ediyor. Öğrenci kardeşlerimize kısa bir hatırlatmada bulunmak istiyoruz. Sevgili öğrenciler, okula gitmek için evden erken çıkınız. Okula gidip gelirken...
This is the Daily Police Radio Record Request Program, presented as always by Çiğdem Arca. Every weekday between 12 and 2, she exchanges her police car and gun for a microphone and turntable and plays some of Turkey's most popular records.
Saat 12'den 14'e kadar 2 saatlik istekleriniz diye program.
We're here to provide a service along with the music. We give traffic reports and try to trace missing people. Sometimes we put out emergency requests for blood donations. Along with these public services, we play music, any record that the people want to be played, from Michael Jackson to Tarkan.
Turkey's police radio started in the mid-70s, where it soon became the country's most popular station, particularly among the young. Like many countries, the Turkish state had a monopoly on radio broadcasts, with strict controls on music. But unlike other countries, it wasn't pirate radio stations which challenged the status quo, but the police. Dr. Kemal Atabek of the Media Faculty of Ankara University.
It's typical public relations broadcasting. However, it turned to be out something else. The broadcasting policy developers on the police department radio, their main interest was to attract people. So they understood very well that to attract people, you should change your musical policy. So most of the musical types which are banned on TRT were on police radio. And it was, on that respect, a very alternative music box.
The voice of the police introducing the country's most popular music could be heard all over Turkey, from taxis to university campuses, with its mix of popular Turkish and Western pop music, all banned on state radio. Sibel Demirtaş was an avid listener when she was at university.
At that time, there were no options to listen to music from the radio stations. There were some state radio stations in Turkey. They played all the musics, all kind of musics, Turkish popular musics, Arabic musics, and the others. For example, they were playing from Pink Floyd or Deep Purple, but they say, you will listen to Pink Floyd and his friends, or Deep Purple and his friends, like this. At the end of the songs and the beginning of the songs, they were saying always and always, love the police. Police is your friend. Help the police. Because police is for you. Like this. Maybe police want to be voice of the people, using the music, using the media.
Welcome to Master Mix on Turkey's favorite radio station, number 1 FM. I'm your DJ, Rudy.
King of the Dark.
I'll be your guide to the underground to feel the rhythm, dance and party.
The sound of number 1 FM, one of Turkey's new private radio stations. The last few years have seen the emergence of an estimated 3,000 private stations. New stations are setting up every week, with the government effectively lifting all controls on broadcasting.
We're going to the studio where the program presents.
But far from conceding defeat to the highly polished productions of private radio, there are plans for an all-new police radio station.
Currently then, Turkish police radio is not only trying to change its image by moving to FM, it may one day discontinue its shortwave operation. It's a most peculiar setup.
Yes, Diana, I'm looking here at the 1995 edition of the Transmitter Documentation Project by Ludo Meiss in Belgium, and I see that only in 1993, that's just 2 years ago, they had a couple of 10-kilowatt shortwave transmitters installed. So they are fairly new, so if they discontinue shortwave, it'll be quite a surprise.
You can say that. What are the frequencies, Andy?
Well, they have just one frequency, Diana, 7370 kilohertz, 7370.
Right, and now to satellite news.
Yes, we've received the new winter schedule of Radio Finland, and I see that they're planning a substantial increase in the use of satellites, and at the same time they'll be cutting back on shortwave. There will no longer be any direct broadcasts in English on shortwave towards Asia and the Pacific, and English programmes for those areas will instead be carried on AsiaSat 2. Satellite transmissions for Europe and Africa on Intelsat 702 will be starting later this year. In addition to existing satellite transmissions via Deutsche Welle on Eutelsat 2F1 and on Astra 1B via the World Radio Network. For North America, Radio Finland will use its own audio subcarrier on Galaxy 5. And by the way, listeners in North America can get Radio Finland's schedule by email from yleus@aol.com. And that's America Online.
Well, Radio Finland is one of the broadcasters attending the Towards 2000 conference here in the Netherlands, and we'll have more on their plans in a future programme. But for now, back to shortwave.
And we have the new English schedule of Channel Africa from Johannesburg, which goes into effect on the 24th of September. At 03:05 hours UTC, the frequencies are 5955 and 9585 kHz. Then at 05:06 hours, they'll be using 7185 and 11900 kHz. At 15:18 hours, Channel Africa will be on 7240 and 9545 kHz, with an additional frequency of 15240 kHz, 15240, between 16 and 17 hours. All broadcasts are intended for Africa, but the station is often heard in other parts of the world. And again, that schedule starts on Sunday the 24th of September, when most international broadcasters will be changing their schedules, and of course that includes Radio Netherlands.
But at night, it's a different world. Go on, find the girl. Come on, let's dance all night. Despite the heat, it will be all right. And baby, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the night in the summer, in the city.
It's been a long, hot summer, at least in this part of the world, during which we've had time to sit back and read some of the backlog of books that have arrived on the Media Network desk.
One of them is not only a superb picture book, it's packed with facts and helpful hints. So far, around 3,000 copies of this publication have been sold, which is pretty good when I tell you it's all about one particular radio, the Zenith Transoceanic. John Bryant and Harold Cones compiled this paperback towards the end of last year. We previewed it on the programme, but now that we've looked inside, we decided to follow up on it.
Well, I wouldn't like to repair a Zenith radio, but I was fascinated by the way they marketed these portable shortwave radios back in the 40s and 50s. The adverts in the book show how listening to shortwave was linked to adventure, either on a far-off expedition to the polar regions or to some tropical island somewhere. The expressions on the faces of some of the women in the advertisements look somewhat forced. They appear a little too excited about hearing the news from France or Egypt. However, you must remember the Zenith radios reached their peak at the time when transatlantic travel was only for the very rich and daring.
The Zenith Corporation started out just after World War I, founded by two ham radio operators, Carl Hassel and R.H.G. Matthews. In fact, they started the company on Matthew's mother's kitchen table and called the first products Zeniths, after ZN in the call letters of their ham radio station. The transoceanic receivers came very much later and were really the work of one very charismatic person. John Bryant, one of the authors of the book, is on the line to give the background.
It's very much the personal radio of Commander Eugene F. McDonald, Jr., who was the third person in the early history of Zenith. He had been a very successful entrepreneur before World War I, served in the Navy during the war, and supplied the capital to really expand Zenith He was a friend of presidents, a jet setter before there were jets by quite a ways, kind of a matinee idol looking guy with lots of money and a very strong leader. He lived on his 185-foot yacht during the 30s, which was moored during the working part of the year, at least, at Navy Pier in Chicago. By this time, Zenith was a very strong radio manufacturer in North America and exporting at least to Latin America and a bit to Europe, I think. By the late 40s, he was very interested, as many people were in North America, were interested in the happenings in Europe and Asia as things headed toward World War II. And he, on board the yacht, and particularly at his fishing camp in Canada, couldn't get news regularly very well. So he asked his Zenith engineers to develop for him a portable shortwave receiver. Portables were really just at that point becoming technically feasible with 1.5-volt filament tubes. This was really the first portable shortwave radio, at least for anything like the consumer market.
The first model took 2.5 years to design and was brought out within a week of the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor in December of 1941. Around 1.5 million transoceanics were built in the course of the production lifetime.
Well, they are a collector's item because, at least in North America and I think South America, they were the most romantic line of radios. They were produced there. It's according to how you count models and submodels of the line, but basically there were either 10 or about 20 models of transoceanics over the 40-year lifespan. And the radio has a real mystique to it. A lot of people who bought them were world travelers. One of the reasons for their great success, Jonathan, was they were about the only portable shortwave radio that made a commitment to shortwave broadcast radio. Rather than having continuous coverage, as all of the competitor radios did that I'm aware of, most of the bands were simply the international shortwave broadcast bands. So, for instance, on the 9.5 megahertz band, there would be a half inch between each 20 kilohertz. So it, even in 1941, it was almost as easy to tune in Radio Netherlands as it is with a digital portable today. So they were extremely effective radios for people who wished to listen to international broadcasting. And then they had this romantic mystique to them that came partly from Commander McDonald's lifestyle and just the fact that they were the portable of movie stars and movers and shakers and world travelers.
Because they were so well made, they've survived in lofts and basements, are now re-emerging in auctions and jumble sales. But why did Zenith stop making new sets?
Zenith left the radio business in 1982, and at the time, as a matter of fact, there was a model of the Zenith Transoceanic with digital dial under development in the laboratory. But Zenith decided that they could no longer compete effectively in the radio field, that they should concentrate on television, which they've done to this day. And since they were going to offer no other radios, they chose not to offer a Zenith Transoceanic. I would tell you, though, that Zenith is even today paying several thousand dollars a year to maintain the copyright on the name Zenith Transoceanic. So there may be some hope, at least, in the future of possibly one returning to the market.
Most of the sets were made in the United States, with the exception of one, which was made in the Far East.
It's known as the Taiwan model. In truth, it was produced for 3 years, and the first year of that production, which was 1979, was done in the United States. And the 1980 and 81 models were assembled in Taiwan at a plant that Zenith owned at that point and then brought back to this country.
Overall, it's an excellent book which gives advice on cosmetic and electrical restoration of the Zenith models too. The book costs $24.95 in the US and is available in most bookstores. It's also available by post from the authors Harold Kearns and John Bryant. They have their own publishing venture called The Radio Professors. Postage costs $2 within the US, $3 to Canada, and $7 worldwide via C-mail. The address for more information is The Radio Professors, P.O. Box 592, Stillwater, and that's spelt Stillwater, Oklahoma 74076. That's The Radio Professors, P.O. Box 592, Stillwater, Oklahoma 74076 in the USA. And the ISBN number for the book is 0-88740-708-0. And the full title of the publication is The Zenith Transoceanic, The Royalty of Radios. The same authors are planning an even more detailed profile of Zenith and its other products, which they've just started researching.
Radio Netherlands, another detour on the path to self-improvement.
Amazing stuff and some amazing calls on the answer line.
Good evening. My name is Hal Honey, and I am calling from Kempton Park, Johannesburg, South Africa. We are just about 20 kilometers east of Johannesburg, and we are in the middle of winter here. Enjoying your program right now.
Hello, this is James Robinson in Birkenhead, England, for Media Network. Question is to Jonathan or Diana. Could you please tell me the situation regarding News Radio 1395 on Astra?
Well, James, as we mentioned last week, Veronica News Radio 1395 will start test transmissions as from 05 hours UTC next Monday, and programs will also be carried on the Astra satellite system, transponder 51, audio subcarriers 7.74 and 7.92 megahertz.
If you like the show, write to us. If you don't like the show, my address will follow at the end of the program. This is your announcer speaking.
The low HF-250 has started to appear in the UK and here in the Netherlands this past week. Kevin Whitehead is the general manager of low production in Matlock, Derbyshire, England. And Jonathan had a preview of the radio at the Towards 2000 conference before we do our own test on it. He wanted to know more about the philosophy behind the new set and, to the point, what is it made of?
It's a die-cast alloy case. It's all aluminium. And we've gone for a silk, black, brushed, anodized finish on this unit. And some of the writing is in red, and the other is in light grey.
Now, the HF-150 was designed as an entry-level receiver. The HF-225 was, in fact, an older receiver, but aimed at, let's say, the serious shortwave listener. Mm. So who's going to buy, do you hope, the HF-250 when it comes on the market?
Well, I tend to feel that this is a replacement for the 225, because the 225 has been out for quite some time now. And although the electronics and what have you in that receiver were very, very good, the case left a little bit lacking. And it's sort of showing its age. So it was time to bring something out.
So what is it? Is it the HF-150 with a couple of extra knobs?
Oh, no, no, certainly not. It's a 225 with a lot of extra functions. This unit has got RS-232 control on it.
What does that mean?
RS-232, it means you can control it from your computer. You can get data either way from the unit. So if you've got a database with frequencies in that you wish to load, you can load all the memories up from your computer. If you're out DXing portable somewhere and you load found frequencies into the memory, then you can download them into your computer when you return. The other option that people have asked for is an extra digit on the display. They wanted to see it down to 100 hertz. And that we've added too. And a fast button. If you press that fast button and hold it press and turn the tuning knob, you're going to tune in 1 kilohertz steps.
One thing I find fascinating is that you've put the speaker at the top of the set. Presumably some design's gone into that to make sure that it pushes the sound forward.
Yes, well, the speaker is fitted in the top, and we have utilised the handle in the same part. So what we did, we really chose a handle that had an open recess at the bottom, and we've spent some time with microphoned and near-field tests to get the acoustics of the audio of the speaker correct.
So what's happening about shortwave listening in general? I mean, is the market stable? What's it like?
It seems quite stable at the moment. Our sales seem to stay about the same, which indicates that the market isn't really sort of declining or increasing. I think it's a case of these days you certainly do get what you pay for. What we've tried to engineer into this set is RF performance with ease of control with a necessarily complex piece of equipment. And we believe that we've scored with those two goals with this piece of equipment.
You mentioned about remote control via computer. Not everybody has a computer, although more people, I hope, have radios. But is there another way of remote control?
Yes, we've got an infrared remote control for the HF250, which is quite a nice little addition to it. You've got the availability to mute, clock, mode, filter and attenuation functions on this, memory, recall. You can tune up and down via the unit. You can put the unit in standby. The unit also has timers. You can program the timers via the remote control and set it, which I think is a very useful feature for somebody who wants to record a station that's going to come on at about 3 o'clock in the morning and he doesn't wish to disturb his wife or his own sleep.
The low HF250 costs £799 in the UK, although the synchronous detector costs an extra £50 and the infrared remote control another £30. Prices in other parts of the world vary according to import duty and the markup by the dealer. It's going to be particularly interesting to see how the low HF250 performs on the market in North America, bearing in mind the recent upgrade to one of the Drake shortwave receivers. So much for the preview, and as usual, once we've had some time to put a production model through its paces, we'll report back.
Some Radio Netherlands wireless news now. Copies of the latest On Target magazine with full details about times and frequencies for the winter season are being sent out from our bureau in Costa Rica as we speak. We also have a stock of this programme schedule here in Hilversum of people not on the mailing list. If you'd like copies sent, then drop us a line to Media Network, Radio Netherlands, P.O. Box 222 in Hilversum, the Netherlands, and the fax number is 31 for Holland, then 35672 4239. That's 31 35672 4239, and the email address, as usual, is letters@rnw.nl. We'll be giving full details of the frequency changes to the winter schedule in next week's Media Network, so make sure you have a pen ready or a tape recorder handy 1 week from today. Before that, though, Diana, we're going to do some changes to the internet pages.
Yes, we're working hard to get our newsletters on the net. So in a few days' time, you can pick up the English language On Target, the Indonesian Ranesi, the Spanish El Sintonia, and the Dutch language publication The Wereld from our internet pages. And apart from that, we're completing our Who is Who sections in all four languages. So if you always wondered what Jonathan looks like, this is the address. http://www.rnw.nl.
So you'll see why I work in radio. One other thing, too, there's another station working on the internet.
Yes, apart from being a TV and radio station, CNN now has become a publisher on the internet. The CNN homepage is called CNN Interactive, and it reminds you of a newspaper. Apart from the headline news, you can choose various sections: US news, world news, business, sports, showbiz, politics, weather, etc. The news is offered in a few lines and a small picture. If you want to know more about the subject, you simply click on it and you'll get the full article. What's interesting about the CNN pages is that audio clips or sometimes even videos of the event are added. One more interesting aspect of the CNN pages is that they give you free access to the Reed Elsevier's LexisNexis databases, containing the archives of around 5,800 newspapers and magazines.
And talking of television, this past Monday evening, the Dutch State Secretary for Culture, Art Nauss, who has broadcasting as part of his portfolio, gave a further boost in a speech in Amsterdam to plans for a Dutch external television service. This is to be run as a joint venture between Radio Netherlands and the domestic broadcaster NOS. No starting date has yet been fixed, but it's becoming clear from audience research that the 350,000 Dutchmen living outside this country's borders would appreciate access to the best of Dutch public broadcasting. All part of the balance alongside commercial television, which of course is already on Astra and Eutelsat.
And that's all for this edition of the programme. Keep your letters and cards coming. In the meantime, on behalf of Jonathan Marks and myself, we wish you a pleasant weekend.
Media Network, produced and presented by Jonathan Marks and Diana Janssen for Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.